This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The dream of creating a universal library has been around since there have been libraries. In the digital age, several research libraries wanted to make this dream a reality but found the project a bit daunting. And then along came Google. They took on the task of digitizing research libraries across the nation into one massive database. This led to anticipation from scholars and lawsuits from publishers. That's the story Deanna Markham and Roger Schoenfeld tell in their new book, which is called Along Came Google, A History of Library Digitization. Here to talk about the project is Roger Schoenfeld. He's program director at Ithaca S&R for Libraries, Scholarly Communication, and Museums. I asked how he and his co-author got involved in this project.
The project actually got started in a really interesting thing. Deanna had been library director of the Library of Congress, so not the librarian of Congress, but basically directed all the library activities there. And then she came to Ithaca S&R, where she led our work for several years. And Peter Dougherty, who's the director of Princeton University Press, was trying to convince her to write a book about the future of the research library. And that kind of morphed into this. It morphed into a story about Google coming to the research library sector and all the different ways that that produced change or could have produced more change in terms of access to cultural heritage and knowledge. And it was one of those great moments where an editor really sees an opportunity.
Were there attempts in the past to come up with a quote-unquote universal library?
There were so many attempts to come up with a universal library. It was really the vision of a lot of research librarians, you know, for 100 years or more. And there were efforts in the print era to build a universal library. You can trace efforts back to the, you know, famous stories of the Library of Alexandria in ancient times. And what happened in the 20th century was that the technologies around building collections and sharing collections across libraries really enabled the leaders of research libraries to see themselves creating something bigger than their own organizations, bigger than their own libraries. And they began to create what are essentially networked libraries that ultimately allowed for resources to be collected and shared across a wide national and even international landscape. So there was a sort of proud history here of every generation used the technology that was available to it to try to expand access to knowledge and build that sort of ever more universal access to knowledge resources.
Was Google the first one to come in and say, hey, we've got this great technology, we can do this for you?
What was so interesting was that there were several major efforts to try to digitize library collections for a decade and more, even before Google came around. There were initiatives coming out of Carnegie Mellon University. There were initiatives out on the West Coast. And there were initiatives from the library community itself to try to share efforts and coordinate efforts to digitize as much as they could. What Google brought that was, I think, unique was that they had an approach that was comprehensive. When they said everything, they didn't mean everything as a kind of 100-year goal. They meant everything as a 2 or 3 or 4 year goal, as a relatively near-term goal. And they were able to catalyze a kind of collaboration across these institutions, across research university libraries, that no one had really figured out how to do before.
Was it always, when they came in, were they always just going to research libraries, or did Google come along and say, we want every book ever published?
Well, that's a great question. They at first came to some of the major research libraries. They started out by digitizing as much as they could. They ultimately digitized just about everything from the University of Michigan library. That was the most significant partner. Michigan has a huge and important research library. Then they have basically been ever since filling in, you know, with ups and downs over the course of time, filling in what else would make for an ever more comprehensive record of publications. It's an elusive goal. No one really has a comprehensive list of everything that's ever been published globally. The Library of Congress has some of that in terms of what's been published in the United States and registered for copyright. A library organization called OCLC has something approaching that. but actually just piecing together what has been published, what should be digitized, and where are the gaps. For a while there was actually something that Google was doing some pretty pathbreaking work on, actually.
Were brick and mortar libraries, as a rule, cooperative with them?
So some libraries were very, very excited about the possibilities here. None of them more so perhaps than the University of Michigan. Lots of others along the way, several dozens contributed to this effort. Others contributed to some competing efforts. There's a huge groundswell of interest in participating in and contributing to this digitization initiative. At the same time, there were concerns from some people in the library community, some academics, folks who are concerned about the commercialization of knowledge in some cases, that Google would take on undue control over the distribution and access to the history of what's been published, that Google could become a bit of a single source or a choke point for accessing our cultural and intellectual history. You know, there was a kind of early period of great excitement. There was then a question about, you know, today we might call it a manifestation of, we might ask if it was it a manifestation of surveillance capitalism, is language that some people might use. You know, today, because of copyright, only a certain portion of the books that Google digitized and that these libraries collaboratively digitized are fully available publicly. Many more of them, you can do a search. It's very valuable. You can do, and very powerful. You can do a search and find the pages of a book that you otherwise might not be able to find. You know, you can access one page or two pages or a few pages of a book. But in those cases where books are, you know, remain under copyright, there's real limits on how much access can be provided. So there's still, one can check that book out of a physical library, or in other cases, purchase it from the publisher or from a bookstore.
Well, it's pointed out in the book that publishers kind of went crazy when they put photocopiers in libraries. So they probably didn't take too well to this, did they?
Yeah, it was a really interesting back and forth. And Google made some choices about how to roll this out that probably didn't earn them any great trust by the publishers. Google initially did a deal with the publishers to be able to create an Amazon-like bookstore. It was proceeding in parallel, but in secret, to work with a group of libraries to digitize the historical collections, the library collections of these books. The publishers, I think, were initially quite enthusiastic because they saw Google as an emerging competitor to Amazon in the book distribution business. And I think there was a tremendous amount of concern at the time that Amazon was, publishers would say that Amazon was behaving monopolistically. And so there was excitement at the prospect that Google could be a counterweight to that and a bookstore that could compete with Amazon. But what we actually saw happen was that, as we all know, Amazon has stayed extremely strong in the book distribution business, both the print books and digital books. And Google, you know, became clear, had some theories about copyright that were not consistent with publishers' interpretations. And so, yes, there were some substantial tensions and eventually a series of hard-fought lawsuits about the arrangements. Eventually, those lawsuits settled, but it was a long, difficult, drawn-out exchange.
And the first settlement that was proposed seemed to make everybody happy, except the judge who rejected it, right?
Right. So the first settlement, it would have been transformative. It would have been transformative for good, or, you know, some people might have been concerned that it would have made Google too powerful. But the first settlement would have had the effect of allowing Google to basically sell access to all of the books, substantially all of the books that had been digitized, make them available through libraries, sell access potentially in other ways, license access to this, you know, unique, amazing, nearly universal library. And there was a whole financial arrangement for how publishers and authors would be compensated for that. And in so many ways, it seemed, depending on your perspective, it seemed either very, very exciting, or like Google would be the only one who could distribute this product and therefore, you know, potentially exercise undue control. Yeah, and then the judge rejected the agreement. The Department of Justice ended up weighing in to oppose this settlement between a series of private parties. The argument was that there could be antitrust concerns about the arrangement, and that as a result, the judge did not approve that settlement agreement. There was a second settlement agreement, but the ambitions of it were much smaller, much more limited. And today, there is no universal access to that library.
There are some books that are still under copyright, but are also out of print. This would have been a perfect way to provide access for those, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. That category of materials, sometimes called orphaned works, because they remain in copyright, but they are no longer available in print, has been a real challenge in this whole system. And one of the things that HathiTrust and Google also have done along the way is made efforts to try to make those materials more widely accessible. Over time, many of these materials will age of copy, all of these materials rather will age out of copyright. But in the meantime, making sure that these materials, even if there's little to no economic demand for them, there could be a great deal of scholarly value and intellectual value to having them more widely available. So I do think that that's one of the promises in all of this, really.
Have efforts to create that access continued, or did they just say, okay, this is the way it's going to be now?
Well, interestingly, the legal front is where those efforts have really continued. One of the moves that the research library community took on, which was so insightful early on, was that they asked to have a digital copy themselves of all of the materials that Google was digitizing. So in addition to Google having a copy, a digital copy, the research library community does as well. And through an organization that they created, a cooperative called HathiTrust, the research libraries have been able to expand their universal library steadily and in some very interesting ways. So in addition to bringing in materials digitized directly themselves or by others and continuing to grow that HathiTrust collection, the research libraries have also made substantial efforts to clear copyright for some of those materials, to identify materials that are out of copyright, to make them more widely available as a result. So that's been one really promising avenue. They've made some substantial efforts to use that digital collection to make materials available for accessibility purposes, individuals with reading accessibility issues, for example. But perhaps most interestingly, during the pandemic, especially in the early days of the pandemic, when so many research libraries, like so many other organizations, were forced to close their doors and they couldn't circulate print collections, the research libraries created, HathiTrust created what they called an emergency temporary access service, which allowed, as a result of the pandemic conditions, allowed any library that had a print copy of any of those digitized books that couldn't circulate the print copy or make accessible the print copy to make accessible the digital copy instead. So they provided access to the digital version. And during the pandemic, that dramatically shifted access to research library collections in a number of the major North American research libraries from primarily print to primarily digital. And I think that proved to literary scholars, historians, sociologists, all of the scholars and their students who otherwise would be using, you know, these vast humanities and social science collections, the value and the power of digitized materials and digital access. And so I think we're actually seeing some regretful dynamics now that many of the research libraries have reopened and have begun to circulate print collections again and have been winding down, in some cases, the digital access. We've seen a little bit of regretfulness that, oh gosh, we have to go back to print, or we're choosing to go back to print. And I think this is sort of a pivot moment for research libraries, where I think users have seen, scholars and students have seen, the power of having digital access to the full text of all of these books has just been so powerful. And we'll see how research libraries will, you know, further adapt and provide that level of service going forward.
It's interesting. Once that bottle's been opened, can you get the genie back in?
It's a great question. And I think in a lot of ways, it was a great example of the kind of infrastructure investments that, you know, the research libraries made without a direct evidence of need. So they invested millions and millions of dollars in creating and maintaining and growing HathiTrust and all the work that went into that. And it, you know, this, the digitization activity, you know, some might have argued that with the failure of the first settlement agreement in particular, many might argue that what was the point of so much of this digitization if it doesn't result in access to all these materials. But in the middle of the pandemic, all that digitization effort paid off tremendously for, you know, scholars and students who therefore could have access. And I think you're right. How you put that genie back in the bottle will remain to be seen.
Again, the name of Roger Schoenfeld and Deanna Markham's new book is Along Came Google, A History of Library Digitization. Still to come, what's it like teaching the 1%? And we're not talking math. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When Blythe Grossberg first started as a tutor and learning specialist, she had no idea what was awaiting her inside the high-end apartments of Fifth Avenue. Children are expected to be as efficient and driven as CEOs, starting their days at 5 a.m. squash practice and ending them with late-night tutoring sessions. She opens the door to that exclusive world in her new memoir called I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. She spoke with Joe Donahue about teaching the children of the very well-off.
I enjoy teaching really any kind of students. I feel it's a calling. So, you know, I found myself in this kind of environment, and it wasn't necessarily something I chose. It was just where I found a job. And, you know, the book is really my exploration of that world, which was not the world that I came from.
So how did you find yourself in this situation? How does that begin for you?
Well, I grew up in rural Massachusetts, and after attending college here, I decided that I had to try my hand at living in New York, and I went to graduate school at Rutgers, New Jersey, and then was employed at a private school in New York. So that's where my contacts were. And, you know, I was asked, as I described in the book, to work with a student at another school. And that's kind of what helped me actually survive in New York and pay for rent and keep food on the table. A lot of the students I work with, not all of them, were in that world.
There's just the culture shock of going into that world, I would assume, and then the day-to-day culture shock of learning of what you have to do as a way of teaching these students and to do what those are hiring you want you to do.
Yeah. You know, I had always attended public schools, very good public schools, but I think, you know, public schools just have a different kind of interaction with parents than private schools do. Some of the interaction with teachers in private schools is actually quite positive in that teachers in private schools have the benefit of working in very small classes, so they tend to know their students really well, and they tend to have a much closer rapport with the parents. So I think that's positive. The negative side, of course, is that, you know, some parents in private schools really try to push their advantages and kind of use some tactics you might describe as snowplow parenting or helicopter parenting, as it was known in its previous incarnation.
And it moved to snowplow parenting? I wasn't aware of that. Is that a thing?
I don't know. Well, maybe that's just because I moved back to Boston, where there's a lot of snow.
Well, but we have snow here, too. But, I mean, it's just that you're always, it's always there to come and clean up the mess. Is that the connotation that we're...
Well, I think the metaphor is that snowplow pushes everything out of its way.
I see.
You know, including cars, snow drifts, or, you know, poles, anything that happens to be in its path.
So other humans. Sure. Okay.
Yes, other humans. So that, you know, is the metaphor that would describe a kind of parenting that is very aggressive, and that where the parents seek to do everything for their child and remove any obstacles in their child's path. So it's not that I was unaware of snowplow parenting or whatever metaphor you want to use.
Yep.
But I just think it was a little more steroidal or kind of exaggerated in some parts of New York City. It's a very hectic city, and, you know, it's a city where you just need a lot of aggression just to survive. And I think some of that energy was also brought to parenting.
So that's a fascinating point. So would your job with the elite be different if you were in another city? Let's say you were working with a rich kid in Sheboygan, and I'm sure there are some, but it would be different.
Yeah, I mean, one of the points I make in the book, which is backed up by research by a woman named Sanaya Luther, who was formerly a professor at Columbia Teachers College, is that I think a lot of this form of snowplow parenting and the stress that parents put on their children is really endemic in the middle class, the upper middle class, and among the very wealthy. You know, I think it's something that people in other parts of the country can relate to, in that parents are attending their kids' travel team games, rooting for their kids to really excel in sports, putting pressure on them in that sense, and really putting academic pressure on them in ways that is not always age appropriate. So while I think it's most extreme in areas like Manhattan, it really is something that I think people in other parts of the country can experience if they attend school in an affluent school district.
So do you like these kids? Are these likable children?
They really are. I mean, I am a softie when it comes to kids. I just love kids. So, but, you know, I think when you kind of strip back all these layers of glamour and wealth, I mean, they really are just kids. And I feel that especially kids of very successful parents are sometimes, you know, they have a lot to handle with their parents' success, and they're a little bit cowed by it at times. So if anything, I found them more vulnerable than I expected, and maybe more vulnerable than other types of kids. But, you know, something I've always enjoyed working with kids is that they seem to at times shake off some of these expectations, and they're just kids, and they like to hang out, and they like to have fun, they like to laugh. And these are all the reasons that I consider myself really lucky for being able to work with kids.
Do you ever feel sorry for them in the sense of that there is so much abnormality that it somehow keeps them from being what a regular kid would be?
Yeah, absolutely. I was able to grow up in the 70s and I had a pretty unpressured childhood. And I think there are a lot of things about childhood that I really remember fondly. And a lot of it had to do with unstructured time and, you know, just playing in the woods or taking a different path home from school and no one really caring and just having all the time to explore things and read on my own. And, you know, that is what I found missing in a lot of kids' lives today. And again, it's probably especially true in a pressure cooker situation like Manhattan, but it's true, I think, in many parts of the country that, you know, kids don't have that kind of unstructured playtime. And if they do, it's often spent playing video games, doing things that I don't think always kind of let their minds roam free and that encourage creativity. So, yeah, I don't want to say that I felt sorry for these kids, but I did sense that there was something missing in their lives.
Again, the name of Blythe Grossberg's new book is I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. You can hear the rest of Joe Donahue's conversation with her on the Roundtable page at wamc.org. So you might not have heard, but hurricane season is in full swing. That means working hard to keep the lights on during and after a storm. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
A failure in the power grid could have serious consequences. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Larry Pileggi, professor of electrical and computer engineering, has this warning about attacks from Mother Nature and cyberspace.
Flip a switch and the lights come on, a seemingly endless supply of electric energy. While mankind has only had electric power for 150 years, most of our global society would no longer survive without it. A reliable power grid is imperative. In a large metropolis, a grid outage could have devastating consequences for necessities such as clean water. Our power grid has demonstrated amazing resilience despite two significant threats, weather and cyber attacks. Weather events continually demonstrate the fragility of the grid. A tree falling on a power line during a storm can cause cascading failures miles away. Processes in place to avoid these failure scenarios are simulated with physics-based models. Every minute of every day, computer simulations evaluate what impact a potential failure could have on the grid. These simulations include contingency analyses that evaluate the most likely combinations of failures due to weather and other natural events. If a grid has 7,000 possible points of failure, evaluating all possible combinations of two concurrent failures would require 49 million simulations. These are complex models of the grid that are simulated millions of times to guide actions that must be performed every few minutes. Moving to less carbon-based energy makes these simulations even more daunting, since we must now predict wind and sun conditions too. But perhaps the greatest challenge to the grid is human-based attacks, since the grid requires a communication network that connects grid components with measurement devices. This networking makes the grid vulnerable to cyber attack. While researchers continue to improve modeling and simulation capabilities to protect the grid against threats from Mother Nature, new simulation models are working to predict and defend against the grid's other threat, human nature.
That was Larry Pileggi of Carnegie Mellon University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.